This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
And we're back here on Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9 with Macca and Nick. And who is our special guest this morning, Macca?
Is Michael O'Brien, MLA, member for Malvern. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Nick. Good morning, Macca.
And welcome. And so what brings a Liberal MLA into the hallowed precincts of Joy?
I was invited to come in here, and it's a terrific opportunity to see what you're doing here. And I love the fact that from up here in your tower of power here on Bourke Street, you're actually looking down on Parliament House.
Just about. It's almost equal. We try to crane a little bit higher if we can.
I reckon if we had a blunderbuss, we could just about hit the Premier's office.
We shouldn't say things like that. No. I'll be honest, like a...
Oh, no, no, the special operations were really down here.
Oh, Macquarie said it again.
I know.
So, Michael, how long have you been in Parliament?
Well, it's my first term. I was elected in 2006, and I, as I think you mentioned earlier on, I replaced Robert Doyle, who, when Robert was standing down and I was pre-selected by the Liberal Party to contest Malvern, I had a chat to Robert, and I said, Robert, look, do you think you'll ever get back into politics again? And he said to me, Michael, no, never, never, never.
So what does he call them? The Lord Mayoralty? Something else in show business, I think.
Yes.
I caught up with Robert last week, and I think it's a job that he's almost born to, because he's a very positive sort of person, and being Lord Mayor, it's about... achieving things, about promoting this terrific city that we live in. And I think the day-to-day grind of being negative in opposition, which is part and parcel of the job, is something that perhaps he didn't enjoy as much as he does now. And good luck to him.
I guess you wouldn't, because you don't want to be in opposition all your life. But it does raise the question of what's it like, how much personality do you have to suppress or put aside when you're in politics or in various branches of politics? And what's the general effect of that?
I think people like to see the personalities of their politicians coming out. You do get criticism from time to time that, you know, we always turn up and we say the same thing and we look the same, and no one tries to be controversial. But I think when you're talking about important issues in politics, you should, you know, if you're passionate about it, you should let that passion show through. And I think if people saw a bit more of that, people might be a bit happier with their political representatives and with the process.
Now, Mac, I know you're burning to ask questions, but I'm going to ask another one. And it is about sticking with the party platform, because we've been discussing earlier, you know, speculating on what the new Prime Minister's stance on same-sex marriage would be. And the response we had from one SMS suggests that she's sticking to the party line. Now, what is this about sticking to the party line? Most people say, why don't you have the guts to go out and you know, say what you really want to say? But there is something important about belonging to a party and sticking to the party line. What's your take on that?
Well, we have a representative democracy in Australia, and when you vote for somebody, you're voting, and when you get your ballot paper in your hand, if that person is running as a candidate of a party, it's got that party name next to them. So when the people of Malvern turn up on the 27th of November this year to vote in the state election, it'll have Michael O'Brien, Liberal, and that means something. You are advertising to your potential constituents the sort of person you are and what sort of values you're taking into politics, I suppose. So I think to turn around and then do something completely opposite to where your party is something which you have to think very carefully about. Now, in the Liberal Party, we actually do have the ability for people to cross the floor and vote against the party line without being expelled. And whereas with the Labor Party, you're bound by caucus rules, and if you cross the caucus line, then you're automatically expelled. It probably just comes from the different values that started the Labor and Liberal parties. The Labor Party was all about, you know, union movement, sticking together.
And solidarity.
Solidarity. Yeah. Liberal Party's always been more about individual views, individual conscience.
Which is hard to bind together in some respects. So when people are voting... they're voting for a party, really, but I suppose in the case of someone like Lindsay Tanner, that after time and experience, or say with Robert Doyle, they start to vote for the person more. Do you think there's a shift as someone is, you know, it strengthens their career and stuff?
I think you're right. I think there are some people who would vote Liberal, Labor, Green, National, no matter who the candidate was. But I think that there are more people, and an increasing number of people, who aren't rusted on party voters, and they will take into account the individual views and performance of the particular member or the particular candidate. And look, can I just say, across party lines. Lindsay Tanner, I think, was a very, very good contributor to the Labor Party and a very good contributor to the Parliament. I think his decision is one that is going to be a loss to Labor and a loss to the Parliament, and it's certainly going to make the Labor Party's chances of holding this seat of Melbourne much, much harder at the election.
Yes, it's good you've said that, Michael, because I think one of the things that often is missing is, and look, I've been around politics a long time, and I know that out of the glare of the Parliament or in public, that members of Parliament do, you know, on both sides, do strike up friendships and talk a lot. But one of the things that's often missing, and it's a lead into my first question, is the relationship between the different political parties and the different members. And we've seen, I suppose it's fair to say, a bit of, I won't call it political theatre, political brutality this week in Canberra. How tough is politics now? I mean, you worked for Peter Costello. I know you're a good friend of Andrea Coote, so, and obviously been involved in the Liberal Party, you know, for some time. But how tough is politics personally? I mean, what's the upside and what's the downside?
There are a whole lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to get into politics, because compared to a lot of other lines of employment, there's more scrutiny. Depending on where you're coming from, you may well be taking a significant pay cut to come in. No matter how well you perform personally, if your party is out of government, then that limits your ability to make the sort of contribution that you get into politics for. People get into politics, I think, because they want to be in government. They want to be part of changing things, improving things, and it's harder to do that from opposition. But having said that, if you've still got the drive and the determination to achieve something, and you're prepared to put up with all the rubbish that goes with politics, then that probably says you're made of the sort of stuff that will hopefully see you through the tough times.
Mm. When you look at what's happened this week, you know, and very telling that, you know, on Tuesday, I watched Kevin Rudd in Question Time, and, you know, he's there, and he's, I always thought he used to get paid by the word, but he's answering he's answering a question or giving an answer, and, you know, he's the Prime Minister, and he's got all the resources of government and the public service at him, and then 2 days later he's sitting on the backbench scribbling away, and the attendants don't fill his water jug because he's not a minister. How, you know, for you, what do you think when you see that? If you can, put the politics aside, on a personal level, and obviously having worked, you know, for Peter Costello, who stood down, how does that affect you when you see that being played out? What do you think?
I don't think that anybody could have seen Kevin Rudd's final press conference as Prime Minister, and however they vote, whatever they think of him as a person, not have felt for him in a human sense, because whatever you say about Kevin, no one would say he didn't work hard. He worked hard, he made his staff work hard, but he threw himself into the job. And putting partisan politics aside, and, you know, the criticisms that people can make from different angles, it's hard to see somebody who has put their heart and soul into an endeavour have it taken away from them so quickly and so brutally. And politics can be a really brutal game. But having said that, you know that is one of the rules when you get in, that you are there and you serve at the pleasure of your constituents and to another extent at your party.
Yeah.
And if either of those groups withdraw their support, then consequences flow. And it doesn't make it any easier to watch it happening, but they are the rules of the endeavour that we've chosen to put ourselves into.
So you know what you're heading for when you step into the ring, don't you, I guess?
Well, it's interesting, Nick, because up at the State Parliament House, when you walk into Queen's Hall, which is sort of the main, just past the entrance point, there are a whole lot of portraits on the wall of former premiers in chronological order. And when you get a new premier's portrait going up, everyone gets moved along one spot and the person at the end gets bumped off.
All right.
I think it's a terrific metaphor for the temporary nature of politics.
Back.
So it's look, I think that if you get into politics, you should go there with clear visions of what you want to achieve, do everything you can to try and achieve them, because you never know when you'll get moved on.
Hmm. It's the whole issue of families of politicians really came home too at Kevin Rudd's final speech with his children in the background there, and I just looked at his son who just looked like he would rather be anywhere else than he was, and thinking, why is he there?
Mm.
Yeah, why?
Well, he's there to support his dad and his mum. But I don't know. But I mean, it's.
But
it's
what do you think? I mean, Michael. I mean, it's is that? I'm not going to ask you. Would you have your kids up there? Because it's such a hypothetical, awful situation to be in. But what is it about? How do you negotiate with your families, especially when the kids are too young to know what's going on? What's the deal you strike with a family? And Lindsay Tanner, same situation. He thinks his family needs him more than the country does, which I think is an amazing thing to say.
Well, I think one of the reasons, there are a number of reasons I chose to enter state parliament rather than put my hand up for federal parliament, but having spent 5 years working as a senior advisor to Peter Costello when he was treasurer and doing that Melbourne-Canberra shuttle and spending 22 weeks a year in Canberra plus other weeks travelling interstate or overseas as the case took you, one of the reasons that encouraged me to enter state parliament is the idea that I'd actually get to go home and sleep in my own bed every night and see my kids in the morning. So there are a lot of other reasons why I think state government has more to do with the day-to-day quality of life of people. If you can't get your train to work, that affects you. If you or a loved one can't get a hospital bed when they need one, that really affects you. So I think state government has a lot to do in terms of tangible outcomes. But being frank, yes, the impact on family life is less for state politicians than it is for the feds.
I mean, it's long hours, isn't it? I mean, it's a 7-day job. Quite apart from your shadow cabinet responsibilities, you have an electorate, and people have issues, don't they? I mean, whether it's, they ring you if the garbage isn't collected sometimes, or, as you say, the train's late. How do you, I've asked Andrea this before and other MPs, but how do you, not keep a straight face, but sometimes when people ask you some of these things, do you ever wonder, like, why are ringing me? if it's a council matter, whatever, often they'll ring their local member. How do you deal with it?
Well, I think I'm very fortunate in that I've got an electorate which is very switched on, and comparing notes with some of my colleagues from different parties in the parliament, I think I tend to get fewer cases through the door of people saying, can you tie up my shoelaces, please? Generally, I say people are pretty switched on, but that means by the time they get to me, they've really tried to resolve issues themselves, and they're usually fairly intractable. So, yep. So I probably get fewer cases through the door, but they're more difficult ones. But look, you have to remember that is your job. And one of the things that Peter Costello used to always say was that none of the things he'd achieved in politics, being treasurer, being deputy leader of the party, any of those sort of things, he said that all flowed from being a local member. And if you ever forget that you're there to serve your local constituents, then they will take that away pretty quickly. And so I've always tried to take that on board. And yes, you do occasionally get somebody coming through your door and you wonder, why are you here?
Why?
but your job is to, if you can't do it yourself, it's point them in the right direction.
Yeah.
And look, people are entitled to courtesy. They do pay your wages. And, I think that when MPs start thinking they're above their electorates, that's when they get into trouble. Constituency, it's relatively well educated. When you look at the ABS stats, the census statistics, it indicates it's got a high level of tertiary education and, I suppose, more white collar occupations than some others. Look, I take in some affluent suburbs, such as part of Toorak, Armidale, Kooyong, Malvern East, Malvern, Glen Iris. That's my patch.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, there are problems in every electorate. It doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor. If your house is broken into, or you're facing some sort of problem where you need the police to get out there quickly, and the police don't have enough people to send a car out, that affects you, and doesn't matter who you are or what your personal circumstances are. That is a real issue, and you're entitled to expect a good
and
service.
Gentility can mask a lot of problems, including poverty. People can be behind those nice leafy suburbs.
Asset rich, but cash poor.
Yeah, all sorts of issues can arise. So, how would you describe, say, the gay and lesbian or the queer population? What's your understanding in your own patch there of people in those areas?
We have the most marvellous little strip shopping areas in my electorate, and the High Street, Armidale, and Glenferry Road, Malvern, and Malvern Road and Wattletree Road, and there are a number of really hard-working entrepreneurs who are gay and lesbian who are working in a lot of our strip shopping centre stores, and they've actually been really affected as all the owners have been by this government's decision to extend the clearway times.
Yeah.
And that's been a really big local issue for us, because by cutting the number of hours that people can park on the road, you're really choking off the supply of customers to these stores, and you're sending people down to Chadstone.
I'm really at a bit of a loss on this whole clearway issue. To me, the amount of difference it makes to the traffic, you know, it's like the old fairway, whatever they used to call it, for the trams. Mm. I mean, I don't understand why the government is so, let me use the term, resolute on this issue, when there is clearly, you know, there's clearly local anger and you know, the councils, the residents, and the shopkeepers don't want it. Why are they so resolute?
Well,
is it just Vic Roads being their usual, you know, well, we didn't think of it, you know, we thought of it, so it's got to be a good idea.
And Vic Roads run the state,
of course. It's a Vic Roads plot. But, I mean, why do you think the government is so resolute on this? I don't understand it.
We've been trying to work that out ourselves, because when you look at the evidence, the clearways were extended in Sydney Road, Brunswick, and they undertook surveys to work out what the time saving was. And the average time saving for a tram passenger was 15 seconds.
Mm.
Why would you take the risk of putting businesses out, inconveniencing local residents, causing all this grief for the sake of 15 seconds? As I said in Parliament, 15 seconds isn't even enough time to get home and watch one of the government's stupid ads telling you how they've improved the public transport system.
You're listening to Michael O'Brien, Liberal MLA for Melbourne. The issue too is if you want to improve traffic flow, get rid of the cars. Do something more long-term about reducing our reliance on cars. We're not really here we'll give you a little bit of latitude messages, but
I want to ask, because one of your portfolios, Michael, is gaming, and this is a really difficult issue. I mean, I'll show my hand here. I think gambling is pointless. Why don't you just take money out of your wallet and set fire to it? Some people get enjoyment from it, accept that, but what can we really do to help problem gamblers? I've known a few over the years. It's like alcoholism and drug addiction and any other form of addiction. How can you really help people?
There's a lot of research that's been done in terms of what causes people to become problem gamblers. And quite often what you find is that problem gambling is a symptom of another underlying issue. And there can be mental health issues. There can be a lot of social dislocation issues. People don't feel they've got support networks. They've got problems that they're trying to escape from. And sitting in front of a poker machine, pressing that button robotically, is something which takes them to a different world for a period of time. So there are a lot of underlying issues that we need to deal with to tackle problem gambling. Having said that, there are some practical things that the governments can be doing. And one of the things that I've been able to achieve from opposition is that this year we essentially forced the government to fund a number of problem gambling trainers, so they can train venue staff to identify the signs of problem gambling, and by doing that, provide a resource so that you can, you know, if a staff member can't identify someone as a problem gambler, they can't try and point them in the right direction to get assistance. So there are a whole lot of small things that need to be done. There are some bigger things that need to be done, such as pre-commitment, which is letting people, setting up technology on the gaming machine so that people can set limits before they start playing. Most problem gamblers will tell you, and I've spoken to a number of them in my job, now they go into these venues with the best of intentions. They're only going to play for half an hour. They're only going to spend $100. Mm. But once they get in front of the machines and the lights are flashing and the sounds are whirring in their ears, all those good intentions go out the window. So we see pre-commitment, where people can set their own limits and then the technology helps them stick to them once they're playing, as a really important game changer, if you like, in terms of tackling problem gambling.
There's a strong link between gambling and mental illness and depression and anxiety in particular. And it was actually, I was going to say earlier, Macca, I was very disappointed that in the whole brouhaha over the change of prime ministership, the I think extraordinary issue of John Mendoza, Dr. John Mendoza, who was the chief advisor to the government on mental health, resigned from his position because of the lack of funding from federal Labor at this stage over mental health issues. And it's just been lost in the mix.
I thought it was interesting, and you might like to comment, Michael, that the professor said that I think there'd been $30 million allocated federally, to some special mental health programs over the next 3 years, when he said it, you need to spend $1 billion. Now, I mean, there's always a demand on governments to fund things, and it leads into my next question. You might answer the mental health one as well, but is government too reliant on gambling revenue to stop it?
I think it's $1 billion
in Victoria?
It's $1.5 billion. It's about $1.6 billion in terms of total gambling taxes in Victoria. We have, and if you look at just the state-based revenue, so forgetting the Commonwealth grants and GST, but if you look at state-based revenue, it's around about 12 or 14% of our tax cake, which puts us up with South Australia as being the most gambling dependent state in the nation in terms of revenue. Look, I think that is a conflict of interest for governments. And what I'd like to see, and what we'll be announcing in due course, is we think we've got some ideas where governments can perhaps take some of that day-to-day running of things like problem gambling campaigns out of their own patch, and perhaps giving it to somebody who wouldn't be as constrained by worrying, well, hang on, what's this going to do to our revenue? Because I think it is an inherent conflict of interest. It probably can't be entirely excised, but I think there are things, practical things, governments can do to try and separate the problem gambling side of things from the revenue side of things.
Now, in terms of gambling, okay, we know poker machines and card games, etc., get people in, but probably one of the original forms of gambling is horse racing. And the argument there is always, oh, it's the employment it creates and all this. And there is a big employment thing, but if it's $1.5 billion, you're talking about around about $100 million a month, $3 million a day. That's a lot of money. And you can talk about, I suppose, providing services and identifying problem gamblers, but when you're talking about this amount of money in the state budget, and I'm not going to go to the thing, it means less police and hospitals and nurses. It's the usual thing. $1.5 billion to if I had my way, I'd say, make gambling, stop it. Make it illegal. Now, people say, well, that's, you're taking away people's choice. People's choice to be miserable. People's choice to lose money. But how can you balance this? The effect of gambling overwhelmingly is to make people's life miserable.
It isn't. I'd actually like to reframe that question a little bit, if I can jump in on that.
Yep.
And so how do we legislate on issues like behavioural things like gambling, smoking? How much can you legislate to change people's behaviour, and what's your feeling about that? How much in terms of legislating? I was thinking if you take away gambling, you're going to create a black market in the same way we do, say, the people who would argue that making cannabis illegal, all it does is put a lot of money in the hands of people in criminals context. So, is it better to make it legal to reap in the tax and then to do something about harm minimization of that sort of thing? Or is it, let's wipe it out? And I'd like to extend that also, therefore, making legal, why are certain aspects of people's behaviour like same-sex marriages and things not legal?
If we look at the gambling side of that to start with, before there was ever a TAB, so you could only ever bet with bookies on track.
Yep.
That didn't stop people betting. There were SP bookmakers in every second hotel around Victoria or around Australia. People would still find a way to bet. So I think that Nick's point about if you don't take something people are going to do anyway, which has got the potential for real harm, and try and regulate it to minimise the chances of harm being caused, then then you're probably not going to help them in the long run. So I think, notwithstanding some of the problems with gambling, I think that regulating it rather than banning it is the better outcome.
Mm.
But look, I take your point. I mean, there are some terrible personal impacts of problem gambling, including suicides. And you speak to a lot of the gambling welfare counsellors, and they will tell you horror stories, absolute horror stories about people who've taken their own lives as a result of problem gambling. But often in those cases, as I say, problem gambling is a symptom of other issues. And I think it's a mistake to just focus on gambling rather than look at some of these holistic issues that are leading to problem gambling. I think a lot of people do enjoy a flutter. I mean, I'm a mug punter. I only ever bet during the Melbourne Cup. I will usually lose more than I win, but I bet so little it makes no difference. But you can enjoy gambling without it actually costing you, without making it miserable, but there is that minority who we do have to do more for.
Many years ago, you know, I used to own a poker machine someone had given me, and it still worked, and I could feed the 20 cents into it, but the thing was I owned the money. And it, you know, I thought, oh, yeah, this is interesting, but I'd do it for a couple of minutes. But other people would come round, and they'd sit there, and they'd play it, like, for an hour. And
did
thinking,
you keep the money?
No, because you could play it with that money as well, okay. But I thought that was funny. Anyway, look, you are, of course, listening to Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9 with Nick and Macca. We're speaking with Michael O'Brien, member for Malvern. And, Michael, look, we've touched on gambling, and I think we've probably dealt with that. If I ask you, if you had to make a list of the three things that you want to achieve as a member of Parliament, what would they be?
It's a really good question. It would be hard to sort of narrow it down to three, but now you've put me on the spot, I'll do my best to answer it. One of the things I think that drove me to stand for Parliament is seeing the difference that good economic management can make to people's lives. I suppose, got politically active. I joined the Liberal Party when I was in my last year at school, 1989. It was, you know, Kayne Kerner in Victoria, Keating's recession in Australia. I saw people who lost businesses, lost jobs, lost homes because of what was happening with the economy. And you think, well, look, a good government or a bad government really does make a difference to people's lives. So I suppose if I had the opportunity to achieve something, would be trying to ensure that we have a government which actually helps having a strong economy, because, you know, if you have people in work because you've got a strong economy, people, you know, are able to do so much more for themselves, for their families. It makes a huge difference. So, look, the strong economy is really important. Before I entered Parliament, I was a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we could do things so much better with our justice system. We call it a justice system. It's a legal system. It's not necessarily a justice system.
Well, it's the old saying, law and justice are two entirely different things,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, and I sort of saw that firsthand in a few instances when I was practising. So I think that we can do things so much better in terms of the way our justice system operates.
Just enlarge on that a bit. In what way do you think, you know, in terms of, look, there's always discussion, it doesn't matter who's in government, you know, the courts are soft, you know, sentences are too short. I see it, my perspective is, the very last thing that happens in prisons is rehabilitation. But, you know, how do you think we can improve our justice system?
I suppose I'd never practiced as a criminal lawyer. I was always a commercial lawyer, but seeing the number of people, and sometimes they're on they were my clients, sometimes they were my opponent's client, but people who were decent people, hardworking, and weren't able to afford access to justice. In some cases, these people had terrific claims. They had been done wrong by other people, or by companies, or by government. But they weren't able to get access to justice to right that wrong,
yep,
because of all the inbuilt problems in the system. And to me, that's it's a fundamental equity issue that we say we've got these terrific courts and this terrific justice system, but if you can't afford to get access to it, what's the good of it?
It's unequal.
So,
isn't it?
And I've sort of seen that from a human perspective. So that's. And look, there's always going to be debates about law and order and sentencing, but even just from that commercial civil side of things, I think there's a lot more that can and should be done to try and improve access to the system.
Mm-hmm. That was two. There's got to be a third. It was economic health, I suppose, improving the justice system.
I'd say education. I've had opportunities to do things professionally in life because I had a good education. I went to a local Catholic school. It wasn't a Xavier or anything like that. But it was it gave me an opportunity to go on to university and to do things with my life that I've wanted to achieve. And I think education is just so important. And when you see the figures that are coming out through some of the testing that's being done, and you see that literacy and numeracy is not where it should be. In Victoria, we've got some real problems with numeracy in particular, and I'd love to think if I could achieve something in politics, it would be improving our education system so that every single child who goes through it can read, can write, can count, and has given themselves the basis to do what they want to do with their lives once they leave school.
Now, you had a Catholic upbringing, and I'm assuming you're still a practicing Catholic.
He's working at it.
It depends on how you define practicing, yeah, I suppose. Yeah. I'm probably a little bit out of practice, but yes, if you ask me to fill in a form, I'd certainly say that.
I think I got the hint that when the Prime Minister was sworn in, she didn't use a religious-based oath, did she?
No, she took affirmation.
Mm. Yeah. So we've got a bit of a change there, and I had a bit of a slag off earlier at Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott for their very strong Christian-based approach to life, because it seems to me it intrudes upon their practice as a politician. Now, how do you? What's the state religion divide for you? How much do you think your belief system impacts on the way you make decisions politically? And I am concerned because at the moment the Catholic Church is not very friendly to us here in the gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex community.
I'd say that my family, my schooling, my friends had far more influence on my upbringing than did attendance at church or anything like that. I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to talk about conflict, if you like, between religion and secularism. People who are of faith, people who aren't particularly of faith, have all got equal entitlements to put forward their views. And rather than making judgments on them based on whether they're Catholic, whether they're atheist, whether they're anything in between, let's look at the content of what they're arguing, their justifications for it, and make a judgment then whether you think their propositions stack up, rather than saying, well, you can't believe what he says because he's a Catholic, or you can't believe what she says because she's an atheist and didn't take an oath on the Bible. I think that to some extent should be irrelevant. I know the media in particular love jumping on what forms people and religion is a big hook for the media, and they often play it up. But I'd be far more comfortable if people looked at the content of the views of our politicians and judge them accordingly, but rather than trying to work out whether they've got their
federally,
views from the Bible or anywhere else.
I think am I just making an assumption from my own perspective here? But it does seem to me that I've been hearing statements from politicians of both sides saying, I could not go near that issue because of my faith background. I could not go near marriage, same-sex marriage, for instance, because it's, and it's, they either say it's because the people don't want it, which I think is a wholly specious argument, because I think the responsibility of a politician is to think ahead, think to the future, and lead people's thinking, and help us expand on that thinking, not just respond.
I mean, how do you? Let's go, Michael, to the question of same-sex marriage. Now, I know it's a,
got about a few minutes to deal with this.
Yeah, it's a federal issue, but one, I'd like to know your position on that, and then how people in your electorate that are going to have different views on that. Is that, how hard is it for you to put that view and potentially change it if you had to?
Hmm.
So first off, what is your view on same-sex marriage?
Well, it's not one that I've had given a huge amount of thought, and primarily because it's being a state politician, it's not something that's going to come before the state parliament. It's a federal matter. But look, you've asked me a question, you're entitled to an answer. I would probably be more supportive of the idea of some federal recognition of same-sex relationships, but I'd probably be more comfortable if that thing was not called marriage. And I think that partly it is because there would be, there would be a strong majority in the view in the community which would say that marriage is man and a woman. Having said that, let's get to the practicalities. Why can't you have recognition in such a way which can therefore overcome some of the discrimination that might be applicable to people who are in same-sex relationships, but then have to go and prove it every time they turn up to a government office or fill out a form? So, I'm probably more interested in the practical side of things. How can we practically remove discrimination? I'd be comfortable with some sort of recognition, but and you could say I'm being a wimp for not trying to lead the community on it, but I'd probably be more comfortable if that recognition was not using the word marriage.
And do you think that's because marriage, I suppose, you made the point that, a majority of the community would think this. And I'm always interested in this because, in our community, in the queer community, there's quite different views, but In Victoria, for example, we have the legislation which recognises couples as domestic partners, and there's no differentiation between their sexual orientation, and that's accepted. And other than one or two of your colleagues in the lower house that didn't support that when the legislation came in, so what's the difference there? Is marriage only an institution, or is it only something that belongs or that is open to heterosexuals? Because to have federal recognition, I mean, my view is that marriage is an institution of the state that's been hijacked by the church. When it's the state that licenses, it's the state that records it, it's the state that legislates it. So is it the word marriage, or is it the fact that it's been a heterosexual activity, for want of a better word, that makes it hard for people to, to say, well, to me, equal means equal. So am I on the right track here, or is it just too difficult?
That is really, really...
The word just too loaded to unpack anymore.
Mm. Look, you made an interesting point, Mac, that it was basically a state institution that had been hijacked by the church. I haven't gone through my history books, but I wouldn't have been surprised if marriage was actually something which perhaps started with the churches and then was synthesized and appropriated by the state.
And state eventually gets everything, doesn't it?
Well, particularly as a state MP, I say the federal government eventually gets everything, it seems. If my supposition is right that it was essentially a religious institution which has then been appropriated by the state, I think there would be some resistance to then the state calling it something which the established churches sort of felt was completely
at odds. Perhaps we should stop calling it marriage.
Well, I know that there's...
You have to throw out a few songs there if you did.
So, I know there's one of your big supporters here, Tim Wilson, who's he's actually put forward an idea that essentially the state should privatise marriage by allowing the state should get out of it and let any church or organisation marry people as they wanted to. So there are a whole lot of very interesting views. I understand symbolism is important, but it's also, I'd prefer to see the legislative time and effort of the federal parliament and the state parliament spent on actually removing practical barriers and impediments and discrimination.
We're going to have to wind up.
We do,
Michael. Any last statements you'd like to make? We're talking with Michael O'Brien, Liberal MLA for Malvern in State of Victoria.
Why should queers vote Liberal, Michael?
Oh, there's one.
Well, look, I think that queers should vote Liberal for the same reason that anybody should vote Liberal, and that is look to what the party offers. It is a party that is based on individual rights, individual responsibilities. It's not part of the sort of the group mentality that marks the Labor Party. So, I think quiz are individuals as much as anything else. And yes, their identity is an important part, but we're also individuals. And it doesn't matter whether you're gay or whether you're straight, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex. If you can't get on the train in the morning and you're late for work, it ruins your day. So vote on the basis of what's actually going to affect you in your day-to-day life.
Thank you very much, Michael O'Brien. And thank you also, Macca, for being with us and joining me today.
And really quickly,
yes,
as we're in the run-up to a state election, we're going to make...
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.